probably recall from the previous meditations, there are three dimensions, three levels of suffering, and for the time being, I just want to focus on one, and that is just the suffering that hurts. It's physical pain, it's mental pain, it's mental distress, anguish, depression, sadness, fear, anxiety. All of those are dukkha. They're manifest, they're blatant. Yeah? And so this is the, one could say, the most superficial type of suffering in terms of dukkha. In terms of dukkha, the most superficial kind. At the same time, we all know that when we're experiencing it, it's at the center of our world. If it's something really strong, if it's an itch, then we can handle it. But, you know, really strong suffering. I know what it's like. We all know what it's like. Both mentally, I mean, I don't think anybody's young enough. No, not even Daniel, our youngest member here. Daniel also knows about suffering, mental suffering. No, age 19, you've had plenty of chance. And physical pain also, we all get. And then Ilsa, our most senior member, also plenty of time to experience just mental distress, physical distress. And we know when it arises, especially when it's really strong, it's intense. Boy, we go into dukkha samadhi. It's almost unavoidable to be totally single-pointedly focused with great stability, not much ease, but great stability and great vividness on the misery. Right? It looms large. It draws us in. It becomes our world. So I think I don't need to give any examples. We've all lived long enough, everyone here, to know exactly what I'm talking about. And we know that when we experience it, it's explicit, it's blatant. There's just an overwhelming urge, make it go away. Make it go away. There may be underlying causes. Maybe there's past karma causes. Whatever causes, right now, can you just make it go away? Yeah? I know, I felt that. I felt that. And there are times when that's the best thing to do. I will give one example where I felt so grateful for the pharmaceutical industry, for the drugs they had. It was a friend of mine, not a very close friend, but he was a friend of mine in Santa Barbara. This was, 8 years ago, something like that, maybe about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. About my age, he had metastatic bone cancer. You would never wish that on anyone. The pain of your bones having cancer right in the bones and eating the bones in from the inside out. So they break like twigs. He broke one leg by just getting out of a car. He stepped on his leg, he put pressure on his leg snapped. So right towards the end of his life, both of his legs were broken. And all of his bones so fragile, they break like twigs. And it immensely painful. I've never had that, of course, not in this lifetime, but terribly painful. So what did he have? He had a little button, and that could control the morphine drip. So they put the control in his hands, and he would take it enough so that he could bear it, that it would be manageable, but not so much that it would completely cloud and overwhelm his mind. Because he wanted to practice Dharma right to the end. And he did. He did. His mind was clear, but he couldn't have done that. He could, I don't know. If he'd had tremendous samadhi already, that's a different case. But no, he didn't have great samadhi. But he had his morphine drip. And with that, he was able to maintain consciousness, clarity, right up to the end. And then, of course, he passed away. But I was just so grateful that they were able to suppress that pain, because it was like a person shouting at you something you already know and from which you can learn nothing. You have bone cancer and it's excruciatingly painful. I know that already. I don't need to be told every minute, every hour, and every day. I don't need to, there's nothing more to learn here. It's overwhelming, it's unbearable. So if there's times, well, if you don't shoot the messenger, put some duct tape over the messenger's mouth, because we just don't need to hear it anymore. The pain is too intense. And that, as we know, that can happen physically. That was the case for him. It can happen sometimes when the mental distress is so unbearable that whatever the underlying causes are, for the time being, just to make it manageable, please manage those symptoms. Suppress the symptoms. And I don't think anybody does it better than the pharmaceutical industry. Good at it. So if I should ever need that myself, I hope I will be able to, for all my criticism of the pharmaceutical industry, and I will continue to criticize where I think they are not acting in the public interest, but on many occasions they do. So I try to be balanced. I know I'm not always balanced, but I try. And here is a case. So that's where I'd like to go in the meditation today. Not go to depth, but there are times when the suffering is just blatant. I was so surprised yesterday. I sent Mugi a whole series of photos from the New York Times. It's New York Times, so that's what I check each day. And they had, after this absolutely brutal winter, I told you about it before, and so many of the livestock dying, just frozen to death standing. Then they had a very, very touching, very artistic set of 19 photos that were taken of primarily the nomads, but other people living in real poverty, but with that intense cold, and now it's springtime coming. And so I saw these very touching, very moving photos. So I sent them forwarded it to my wife, because she loves Mongolia, and she goes there every summer. She's going again for 2 months this summer, strong connection. And then, of course, dear Mugi, whom this is his homeland. And so I sent that to him, just I thought, well, see some photos, you know. And lo and behold, out of 19 photos, the fifth one was of his brother. And his brother's wife, and his nephew, that is their little baby girl. So out of 2.5 million Mongolians, they managed to get Mugi's family. So you can touch him if you like. He's something of a celebrity now. His sister and brother in the New York Times. Front page. So there we are. But there's one of so many cases, and of course you can't, I hope you're not checking online all the time, it will just distract you, but that's what I am. I'm crossing two worlds of being in the world and meditating and helping you all as much as I can. But of course we all know you can't open up any newspaper, digital or paper, without on the front page something bad happening. It just never, have you ever seen a newspaper where the whole front page was just covered with good news? I've never seen that in my life. And so what we get is blatant suffering. And it's everywhere, and it's every day. And so that's why I'd like to direct the meditation this afternoon, starting with ourselves, extending to others. Compassion for ourselves, giving rise to a spirit of definite emergence, of renunciation. But kindness for ourselves too. I just hear so many times here and in so many other retreats and just generally, we folks, especially of modernity, much more than really traditional cultures, where Mugi comes from and Tibetans I've known from Tibet, we're so tough on ourselves. I can't count the number of times that I've just met with you one-on-one and you'd say things about yourself that if anybody else said them, I would say, oh, that's so abusive, so unkind, maybe even cruel. What a put down. If anybody else said, oh, that person really doesn't like you, the way you just refer to yourself. You know, so uncharitable and not giving yourself a break, you know, and this is for yourself. And I know it well. This is not a criticism anyway, but I certainly know it well from the inside. And it'd be good to stop. Maybe we can. Grasping, we can't stop. OCDD, we can't simply stop. But maybe dumping on ourselves, putting ourselves down, judging severely, criticizing, maybe we just stop, you know. And when we suffer, feel compassion for ourselves. And when we find that our minds are dominated by mental afflictions, feel compassion for ourselves. And then we have a base for feeling compassion for others. Yeah? Good, let's do it. As an act of kindness for ourselves, settle the body in its natural state, the breathing in its natural rhythm, and calm and soothe the mind by way of mindfulness of breathing for a little while. And arouse your attention to focus on your own situation, your own life. The types of suffering that you bear, the challenges, the difficulties. Some may be physical. Some may be psychological problems, difficulties, distress that you carry with you. Traits, habits that you carry with you from week to week, month to month. But some of the dukkha, the blatant suffering, may be also very explicitly relational. In relationship with certain people you find difficulty, you find difficult, situations you find quite stressful, painful. some difficulty seemingly imposed from outside, other ones very clearly self-imposed, dukkha. In terms of manifest suffering, survey the range of suffering to which you are vulnerable. And if you will, arouse the yearning with each in-breath. May I be free. May I be free of suffering. And as you alight, or let your mind, your attention, alight upon different types of suffering, bringing them vividly to mind, breathe in, and with this in-breath, arouse the aspiration, may I be free. And if you will, you may imagine them in the form of dark smoke, being siphoned in or drawn in to the light at your heart. And imagine this whole range of explicit, manifest suffering dissolving without trace in the light of your heart. Imagine being at peace with your body, your mind, with other sentient beings, and the natural world around you, free of suffering. Then let your attention rove where you will, to individuals, to regions of the world, to communities, to phases of life, to those who are ill, injured, to those who are aging, to those who are dying. Let your attention alight where it will. And with each in-breath, arouse the yearning of compassion. May you be free, free of suffering. And with each in-breath, as you attend to these individuals or communities, imagine the burden of their suffering and pain lightening until it is gone. Then let your awareness expand in all directions. The field of your awareness embracing all those here in the valley. Human beings and non-human beings alike. As sentient beings, we share this in common. We're vulnerable to suffering and we wish to be free. Breathe in and arouse this yearning of compassion. And let the sphere of your awareness expand from breath to breath. Without barrier, without limit. And release all appearances and all aspirations, and let your awareness come to rest in its own nature. Let's bring this session to a close. Oh, Lasso. So there's one follow-up question. This is from Mary, but it really pertains to Noah's question yesterday and one aspect of the question to which I didn't give an answer. Fancy that. And the question is it possible to be a bodhisattva and not know it? The short answer is, I don't know. The commentary is, it takes one to know one. It takes one to know one. In English, that means you have to be a bodhisattva to really know what it's like to be a bodhisattva. So that's the short answer, but you know I always have a longer answer up my sleeve. And that is, I strongly suspect that you could be a bodhisattva without knowing it. In fact, it seems almost certain for the following reason. And that is, imagine that someone here becomes a bodhisattva in this lifetime, sustains that flow all the way through death, through the bardo, and perhaps, again, since we can remember many things, especially in the early phases of the bardo, you still remember, there's still that ongoing continuity. As a bodhisattva, you're probably going to have a very pleasant bardo, very peaceful, wise, compassionate. Even if you're not lucid, even if you don't have very profound insight, if you're a bodhisattva, you'll have a nice bardo. You can almost count on that. But then imagine you come to the end of your bardo, and moved, motivated by your compassion, then you take birth, just like, as Gelam Rimba, the yogi said, may I take birth wherever I can be of greatest benefit, just out of the sheer power of your motivation and all the virtue behind it, of course the ethics. Let's imagine that you come back and you take another rebirth as a human being. Well, how much do you really know during the first couple of weeks of gestation? I kind of don't think you'd know a whole lot. Don't know, but I kind of suspect. You don't have much of a brain, and you're not in the bardo anymore, and you're back in gross mind or coarse mind territory. But now this infant, this embryo develops, a sentient being develops, gradually becoming human. Just as a little footnote, entirely unrelated, just a curiosity, I find it very interesting, that in the Kala Chakra system, so the most esoteric, the most elaborate aspect of Vajrayana Buddhism, oh, it's said that during that last trimester, the last 3 months of growing in the womb, it's said that the being in the womb, the child, has scanned through multiple lifetimes, like a Rolodex, just you get some kind of a quick review of many, many past lives. I thought that was interesting. Just kind of an isolated bit. Wow. Interesting. Then I learned entirely independently from the other side of the fence, since I walk across so many fences, from, I think it was probably from Stephen LaBerge, that during the last trimester, the last couple of months, they make some very sophisticated, very subtle measurements of the physiology of the unborn fetus. And judging by the measurements they can make, obviously from outside, they can say with pretty high degree of confidence that during those last couple of months, the unborn baby is spending, what was it, something like 90% of the time dreaming, in the dream state, REM sleep. A lot of time. I can't remember exactly the percentage. It was a lot of time, though. So when you consider that, little baby, not even born yet, it's been in the dark its whole life, this life. What's it dreaming about? Boring, dark, squishy, warm, dark, squishy, warm. oh boy, dark with squishy warm. this is a really boring dream. I mean, how much content could there be? If the materialists are correct, that that baby just has no history at all, that'd just be one heck of a boring dream going on for week after week. On the other hand, if the, for example, the Buddhists are correct, maybe what they see from outside as REM sleep is the Rolodex period of just going through lifetime. You don't see it. Gosh. But that was a tangent. But now imagine, so the baby's born and comes out, starts squalling, little newborn baby. Presumably, especially if it's not a highly realized bodhisattva, let's say kind of more baby bodhisattva, earth-like bodhicitta, gold-like bodhicitta, stage of accumulation. So, like that. Oh, it's very possible that little baby really doesn't know much of anything, except for hungry, don't like the poop in my diapers. It's pretty basic things. So I would imagine a very young baby, even a bodhisattva, if it's not, you know, super highly realized, my speculation would be, probably doesn't know that it's a bodhisattva. Then that could carry on. That could carry on. Again, what does it take? This goes a little bit philosophical here. But what does it take to know that you're a bodhisattva? If you don't know what the word means, if you don't know what the referent of that word means, will you know that you're a bodhisattva without knowing a bodhisattva is one in whom bodhicitta arises spontaneously, and that is the aspiration to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient being? If you don't know what the word means, you don't know what the concept means, do you know that you're one? Maybe, maybe not. I kind of doubt it. And so, but then as one grows up and the force is still with you, I mean the force, that bodhicitta, just flowing through like a current, you'd be one of those exceptional children. And you may have seen such children, you may know such children, you might even have such a child. But I think we all know of them. Some children that are just divine. they're just not like other kids. They're just so sweet, so giving, so gentle. And there are kids like that, we know it. And we know it, they didn't learn it from their parents. They haven't had a chance yet. You know, not much of a role model yet. So that can be displayed. And that's what you would expect of a baby bodhisattva, or a little child bodhisattva. So gradually it would probably become clear, with or without the label, that one is operating from that mode, from this mode of really selfless compassion and a natural, powerful inclination, irrepressible inclination towards enlightenment. But I was thinking of one other aspect of that before we move on to another aspect, and that is one of the things I found I just savored a lot, a great deal, I still do, in Mahayana Buddhism. And I don't know, maybe Hinduism is like this, I just don't know enough. But I do know from Mahayana Buddhism that it said that once you've cultivated this bodhicitta and it arises spontaneously, then it is that which motivates you, it moves you, it directs your consciousness. And it is said, now this is just absolutely mainstream Mahayana, it's not contested, it's not a sectarian issue, that as a bodhisattva, you may take birth in a Christian family. And they didn't say explicitly Christian, but you may take birth in a Muslim family, a Christian family, an atheist family. You may become a scientist, you may become a philosopher, you may become a midwife, you may become a restaurateur. And that is, there's just no walk of life in which the bodhisattva wouldn't possibly take rebirth. The bodhisattva, one dedicated to achieving enlightenment, perfect enlightenment of a Buddha, might take birth in a Jaina family, a Taoist family, in a communist family. And moreover, they may not only take birth there and then run away from home, like one good friend of mine was born in a Hindu family. He's Indian, a quite high-level Indian, as I recall, in terms of his caste. And so there he is, very traditional, extended family, good family. He ran away from home at something I can't remember exactly, at the age of 8 or 10, 11, like that. Ran away from home to join a Buddhist monastery. He just wouldn't come home. He just, I want to stay here. So this kid was, he's quite special. I know him well. I have a lot of admiration and respect for him. But so he, even though born in a Hindu family, that's not where he wanted to remain. His inclination was, I want to go back home, get back to my spiritual path. And so he's been a Buddhist monk now for years and years, from the time maybe he was a kid. And oh, the blessing, he's had some really good karma because he was able to be very close to some of the most extraordinary, accomplished masters of the last 20 years or so. So some may be born in Hindu and then gravitate off. I was born in a very good family, Christian family. Very devout, father's a very good man, ethical man, mother, very loving mother, both very devout. Both sides of the family, Christians all over the place. But by the time I was 20, it was time to go. You know, it's time to go. This isn't home for me, spiritually, this isn't home for me. And I picked up one book in Tibetan Buddhism. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, just follow that little bell, because that's home, you know, like the old cow. And I just knew it from one book. That's home. And it's been told, and it turned out to be true. 40 years later, what initially attracted me is what absolutely captivates me now, and it was Dzogchen. You know, with all of the richness of Tsongkhapa's teachings, the Mahayana, the Theravada, tremendously important to me, and the Vajrayana and so forth. But it started with Dzogchen, and I say, Dzogchen at the beginning, Dzogchen at the end. So for some like that, but what I find so interesting is not that you might simply be born someplace and then gravitate back to the Buddhist fold. What much more interesting than that is that you may be born in a Hindu, all of these different types of families, environments, places, Africa, South America, Inner Asia, and so forth and so on, and stay there, grow up in that tradition, and become a teacher of the tradition. You might become a Hindu Swami, you know, or a Taoist sage, or a Christian preacher, you know, or a Jewish rabbi, and so forth and so on. And you're still a bodhisattva, and you're teaching the Torah, you know, or you're teaching the Quran, and you're teaching in such a benevolent way, drawing out all the goodness of this great classic within religious literature, and drawing it out, the benevolent aspects, the compassionate aspects, drawing that, emphasizing that, right? Or from a humanist, it doesn't have to be religious. You might grow up as a secular scientist, you might grow up as a secular philosopher, or who knows what. And then you'd bring your goodness to that, you know? And that's the bodhisattva way. I must say, I really resonate with that. Really resonate with that. So, there's one aspect. Now, when I was laying out, responding to the question yesterday, how do you develop bodhicitta, where do you go from there? I won't reiterate what I said yesterday, it's there. But that path, how do you develop? Okay, the four immeasurables, etc. That I would say, oh, it moves my heart. I mean, it's utterly, I'd say, oh, hallelujah, 100%, yes. And that's a developmental approach. It's magnificent. Developmentally cultivating loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, to the point that the barriers are all shattered in tatters on the ground, and your heart just flows in all directions evenly. Then rising to great loving kindness, great compassion, the extraordinary resolve, bodhicitta itself, and then proceed from there into, for example, the satipatthana, again developmental, seeking insights that you don't have, investigating carefully, rounding it off, capping your bodhicitta with this insight, and thereby moving from earth-like to gold-like bodhicitta. That's really noble. Is it the only way? Well, I said yesterday, of course, there are different ways of developing bodhicitta. So there's no question that's not the only way. Absolutely no question at all. But is there another approach? Is there another approach? So developmental, is there a discovery approach to realizing bodhicitta? So I won't even say developing bodhicitta, I won't even say achieving bodhicitta. Is there a discovery approach to realizing bodhicitta? The answer is yeah. I have strong confidence. And here, I'll go back to the one book I'd have with me on the desert isle if I could only have one, and that's the Vajra Essence. And the path there, after this brief reference to doing the preliminaries, without explicating which ones, just said seven, so it could be the seven limb puja. Could be, you know, prostrations, chakse, wadan, chuching, making offerings, shakpa, disclosure, confession, jesi yirang, taking delight in virtue, or asking, requesting for the wheel of dharma to be turned, requesting the enlightened ones, the arhats, to remain, not pass into nirvana, and dedicating merit. Right? That's seven. That's a pretty good seven. Right? Could be that seven. It could be the seven that winds up in the footnote of my translation. Could be another seven. I don't know. But with that basis, he said, do them. And then right into shamatha. And the way he refers to it, it's so interesting. I find it utterly fascinating. Because what he calls, what I've been calling settling the mind in its natural state, which is what Lerab Lingba, another Dzogchen master, called it, very common, Sem Nelu Baba, you're all familiar with that. But what Dujum Lingba calls this, when he's just setting up the path right towards the beginning of the text, then he said, okay, there are two phases here, two large-scale phases to launch, to get to the point that you're really explicitly practicing Dzogchen. The first one is Nang Rik Lam Du Kewa. Nang Rik Lam Du Kewa. And that is taking appearances and awareness as the path. Taking appearances and awareness as the path. Well, you look at the description, you say, I know this. This is settling the mind in its natural state. It's not different at all. It's exactly that practice. And so I allude to the practice as it's laid out in the Vajra Essence. Many times in the Attention Revolution, I come back to it in the Mind and the Balance, and I'm sure I'm going to come back to it again in future books, because it's so just, it's radiant. And I find reading it, I think I've read that opening section, gosh, I don't know, 10 times, 20 times by now, I don't know, many times. But it's so interesting, you're just taking reality as your path, and specifically, most especially, the appearances arising to your mental awareness and your awareness of them, and taking that as the path. In other words, this is naturalistic. You could be focusing on a Buddha image, but only a Buddhist one want to do that. Or maybe an image of Jesus, but probably, by and large, that would be Christians who want to do that, and so forth. But this is taking something that's already present, simply part of nature, taking that as your path. Settling the mind in its natural state. That's quite interesting. And then he gives the most detailed, the most explicit, clear account of how the mind, your sem, your ordinary mind, coarse mind, dissolves in the substrate consciousness, all appearances dissolve in the substrate. I've never seen anywhere so clear. That's probably, in saying that, I'm probably simply expressing the vast scope of my ignorance. But among the few books that I've read, this is the clearest I've ever seen. And happily, because I have a strong, I don't know if it's strong, but how do you say, a pretty significant basis in Tsongkhapa's teachings, the Gelugpa teachings, just seeing, it's compatible, it all fits. There's no refutation here. It's all fitting together like a beautiful mosaic. So that's the first phase. And then, as he's laying out the structure of the path, he's asked Samantabhadra, the teacher in this mind dharma. One of the bodhisattvas asks him in this visionary teaching, he asks, since taking appearances and awareness as the path, since that just takes you to the substrate, and you gave that 2.5-page list of all these awful, mostly awful, nyam arising, it sounds really difficult. And he said, do we have to do that? And Samantabhadra said, yeah. That is, you've got to cut through. You have to achieve exceptional sanity. You have to discover your birthright as a sentient being, let alone your rikpa, your ultimate. Your birthright as a sentient being, where did you come from? You came from the substrate consciousness. It's from that that your psyche emerged. Where did your body emerge from? All the appearances, and that's all we know of the body. Nobody knows anything about the body except for the appearances. Whether you're looking at somebody else's body, those appearances are arising from your substrate. You're looking at your own body, feeling your own body from the inside, all the appearances are arising from the substrate. So all of your mind is arising from substrate consciousness, and all of your experiences of the body arising to meet you, the appearances of the body arising from the substrate. So you need to find your way home to a state of balance, of equipoise, bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality. Arrive there, and then he says, don't get stuck. Don't cling, don't grasp. If you grasp to the blissful aspect, the preference, the clinging, the identification, I want this, I don't want to let go, you'll die sooner or later. That won't make you die, but you will die. And then because of that grasping, you'll just be propelled off to birth as a deva in a desire realm. Durkam kila. Durkam kila pengere. if what you really like is the luminosity, you cling to that, you crave to that. In that clinging, that craving, that identification, that preference, you're accruing karma. You're accruing karma. And that will propel you off to form realm. Whereas if what you really gravitate to, you savor more than anything else, the silence, the stillness, the non-conceptuality, the space. Off you go to the formless realm. In other words, just more samsara, more propulsion into this cycle. So he says, don't get stuck. Don't get stuck. The Theravada tradition says, don't get stuck in the Bhavanga. Tsongkhapa says, don't get stuck. They all say, don't get stuck. Get there, don't get stuck. And then what's the next phase? If you don't get stuck, you say, I heard you. Okay, I'm ready to come out. As blissful it is, nice it is to stay. Okay, I'm ready. I do have renunciation. Ready to go. What's next? And then it's called Chunyat Lamdakewa. Chunyat Lamdakewa. Dambo Nangrik Lamdakewa. Tani Chunyat Lamdakewa. Chunyat means, it's Dhammata, for those of you who know the Sanskrit. Dhammata, ultimate nature of reality. So you've taken conventional nature of reality, without any investigation, no vipassana, no probing inside into the ultimate nature of anything. You're taking the conventional nature of reality, which consists of what? Appearances and awareness. What else is there? What else have you ever experienced apart from appearances and awareness? Anything else come up? You take conventional reality as your path. You transform that into your path to achieve shamatha. And then you take dhammata, which is a synonym for emptiness, shunyata, ultimate nature of reality, and you take that as your path. So he goes directly from there to vipassana. And now you're probing, now you're taking this mighty sword, this very sharp sword of your shamatha, and aligning that, orienting that, directing that with inquiry, investigation, or duendambe dache jeba, investigating the nature of your mind, yourself, your body, and then you go out and you investigate, you probe into the nature. What is the referent of terms? And you look, what is the nature of the referent, the actual referent? So you hear a word, house. House. I know what house is. There's one. There's a big house right over there. Good. What's the house? What is there from its own side that is actually the house? Is it this just front? No, that could be. This could be a movie set. That's called a facade. That's a wall. Right? So where's the house? Where's the building? And you investigate. Investigate. The Buddha taught this exactly in the Pali Canon, in the investigation of the chariot. The chariot. And which part, which of the components of the chariot is the chariot? And then he comes, I can't quote him, but it's pretty close. The chariot is a label. So you investigate. I will try to sum this up, but this is not an argument, oh, this is true. I'm telling you, here's a path. And then especially when you achieve shamatha, then you can really see what it's like. And Gijingon Taige, our first teacher, Mervyn Zamite, first teacher back in Dharamsala, he said, oh, once you've achieved shamatha, vipassana is not so difficult. Not so difficult. So you really probe into, but you're taking the ultimate nature of reality, ultimate nature of phenomena, and you're taking that as your path, and you move from shamatha to vipassana. And you realize mahashunyata, great emptiness, the emptiness, the absence of inherent nature of all phenomena. All phenomena. That all phenomena have no more ontological substance, ontological reality, existence from their own nature, from their own side, than the phenomenon in a dream. Neither space, time, mass, energy, mind, people, nothing has its own existence. You realize that. Now, as I did mention, I've mentioned a number of times by now, if you're really looking for an absolutely non-elaborated path, the simple path, bare bones path, just what is absolutely indispensable path for Dzogchen, then according to Dujum Lingba, and since 13 of his disciples achieve rainbow body, I think he must know what he's talking about. And he's so revered in this tradition. And they say 1,000 of his disciples gained direct realization of Rigpa, It's absolutely astonishing. But clearly an august master. And his next incarnation became the head of the Nyingma order in the time of its greatest crisis. I think it's a safe statement. Because when was ever a greater crisis in the whole history of Tibet than the Chinese communist invasion and genocide and the really concerted effort to obliterate Buddhism entirely out of Tibet? So that was the greatest crisis, I think, since the time of Lang Dharma, going way back, centuries and centuries. And so who was it that had the prayer, the aspiration to take birth and to be in a position that as a meritocracy, because this was, he wasn't born into the position. The Dalai Lama was born into the position of Dalai Lama. He was simply recognized. But Dujum Rinpoche, Jigme Yeshe, he wasn't simply born into being the head of the Nyingma order. No, he was one of quite a number of, well, a lot of lamas, a number of extraordinary lamas, such as Dingo Kenzi Rinpoche, and Dushi Rinpoche, and Gangyur Rinpoche, and others, all from Tibet, all extraordinary masters. And among them all, they voted him in this time of the greatest crisis in the whole history of Tibetan Buddhism. They voted him to be their leader, to draw the tribes together. Say, okay, you'll be our representative. You'll represent our whole tradition. Dujum Rinpoche. He was the incarnation of Dujum Lingpa. So quite some extraordinary prayer, as well, let alone realization. It was said that he was the incarnation of Dujum Lingpa's mind, taking on form. So, what does he say then? Well, you know what he says, that if you want a very fast track, shamatha vipassana, and you can bypass state of generation and completion, you may just go directly to tekchut, the breaking through, right to pristine awareness. Now, without going into the full detail of this, there is one point here, and that's actually still a response to Noah's question, and that is, with your shamatha, with your vipassana, then you follow the path, you learn and you embrace, you immerse yourself in the Dzogchen view, the Dzogchen meditation, Dzogchen way of life, all clearly set forth in this text. And imagine you actually do realize Rigpa. I mean, that's what the whole point is. You realize Rigpa. You realize your Buddha nature. Well, there's an allusion to this, although this section of the text, of the actual tekchut, is maybe three quarters of the way through the text. There's an allusion to this right in the first 30 pages in the shamatha section, where there's kind of this glancing ahead, this looking ahead. And the question is raised, if you do realize Rigpa, Buddha nature, primordial consciousness, if you realize that, do you need to look elsewhere? This is one of the questions posed by one of the bodhisattvas in this visionary teaching. If you've realized Buddha nature, do you need to do something else to develop bodhicitta? And Dujum Lingpa showed, Dujum Lingpo or Padmasambhava Samatabhadra, the teacher then showed also an ability for irony. So I'm following great tradition of irony. and it really was an ironic comment. It was almost like, give me a break. You've tapped into ultimate bodhicitta. Relative bodhicitta emerges from ultimate bodhicitta. There is no such thing as bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta. The bodhisattva ideal, the bodhisattva's motivation, there is no such thing as what we call bodhicitta, apart from it being an effulgence of Rigpa, ultimate bodhicitta. So once again, there is a difference of terminology here. In the Gelugpa tradition and that whole lineage there, when they speak of Dunandambe Chanchukisem, ultimate bodhicitta, they're not referring to realization of the innate mind of clear light. They're referring to realization of emptiness. So this is simply a different usage of terms. Now, if we just take a sidelight there, is it sufficient to gain a direct realization of emptiness? Will that necessarily give you realization of bodhicitta? Realization of emptiness, which in the Gelugpa tradition is called ultimate bodhicitta. Will that give you automatically bodhicitta? The answer is unequivocally no. No question about it. That's where we bring out the two wings of enlightenment, relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta. So on that plane, both of these operating out of coarse mind, semrakpa, coarse mind, or even subtle mind, but not the very subtle mind. This is sutrayana. You're dealing with coarse mind and subtle mind. There are no references to very subtle mind in the straight sutrayana, in, let's say, prajnaparamita and like that. I have to be careful. I'm not even sure that's quite correct, but the practice of vipassana is not directly going to Rigpa, or the innate mind of clear light. The practice, the cultivation of bodhicitta is not going directly to the innate mind of clear light. I can't say there's no reference, that's too much. But now in the Dzogchen tradition, the terminology is different. And bear in mind, words have no intrinsic meaning. They don't define themselves. So in the Dzogchen tradition, when they're referring to ultimate bodhicitta, they're not referring to realization of emptiness. There's no question, they're not. What they are referring to in ultimate bodhicitta is nothing other than Buddha nature, Rigpa, primordial consciousness, Tathagata Garbha, Taishin Shepi Nyingbo, Sugata Garbha, Devara Shepi Nyingbo. And so at this point, when this question comes up, then the Buddha, or the teacher within this context, is really quite ironic and said, this is like having, what did he say? I don't remember the analogy exactly, but he said it's like having an ocean of water and then looking else, and then having a teacup and looking elsewhere. Where shall I fill it? Something like that. It was kind of like, don't even think that way. If you tapped in your Buddha nature, then relative bodhicitta arises spontaneously. You don't develop it. You simply discover it. And you become a bodhisattva by way of realizing your Buddha nature. And that's how it comes up. So that was quite something. So it seems quite clear you can develop bodhicitta top down, or you can discover it bottom up. But it's still bodhicitta. And from that point, once you realize Rigpa, you become Vidyadhara. You gain that direct, unmediated, absolutely non-conceptual, inconceivable whole realization of Rigpa, become a Vidyadhara. Then you proceed along the path of the Turtkel, and you finish the job. That's when you finish the job. Okay? So that's that, something like that. And then on that same line, here's a question that is, related, so I'll just go to this one next. This question from Ilse. Is what you teach about pristine awareness or primordial consciousness, is that comparable to Yogacara, mind-only school, and if not, what is the difference? The Dzogchen tradition is very clear that the Dzogchen view is not the same. There's no question. I don't think it's debated by anybody. That the Chittamatra view is not the same as Dzogchen view. Not the same. Tsongkhapa, for example, we get this corroboration all over the place. They're not the same. The Chittamatra is a straight Sutrayana philosophical system. And I've spoken with some people who've really studied it carefully, and I've said, have you found, what do they practice? What do they practice? Difficult to tease out. John Powers did his doctoral dissertation on it, has written on it extensively. I wrote him, he's done some very good work. And I wrote him, said, what do they actually practice? He said, it's hard to say. The Chittamatra as such is a philosophical system. It's rooted in practice. Of course, practice of ethics and samadhi and so forth. But what exactly is the nature of the vipassana? I'm sure it's there. John Powers didn't represent himself as, you know, omniscient in terms of the Buddhist tradition. But it is clearly Sutrayana. And Tsongkhapa, the great Tsongkhapa, master of all schools of Buddhist philosophy, he goes out of it, and he's a proponent, advocate, brilliant advocate of the Madhyamaka view, and specifically Prasangika Madhyamaka view, philosophical view. And he defends it with a lion's roar. And he refutes Chittamatra. Boom! Shows why, not that every aspect of it is wrong, that's, of course, it's not that delusion, it's not that wrong, but some of its core assumptions, namely about the inherent nature of the mind, that the mind alone is real, hence Chittamatra, mind alone is real. He refutes that. He refutes the Chittamatra version or representation or view of alaya vijnana, substrate consciousness. He refutes it. Prasangika Madhyamaka generally refutes the Chittamatra view of alaya vijnana, but bear in mind it's not the same as Dzogchen. Because it comes with, there are big fat tomes, big thick books about the nature of the alaya vijnana within Chittamatra. It comes with very conceptual, very elaborated, lots of philosophy there. And Tsongkhapa comes in and said, you've reified it. And no, we don't accept the alaya vijnana at all. It was almost like you've reified it and junked it up so much. We just say, no thank you. We will simply assert the subtle continuum of mental consciousness, and we won't call it alaya vijnana, because we'll give it to you. It's like, okay, Chittamatra, if you want alaya vijnana so much, you can have it. We refute you and your alaya vijnana together, both. Cheerio. And we're just going to go with this streamlined, subtle continuum of mental consciousness. So Tsongkhapa clearly, and the whole Prasangika Madhyamaka lineage, going back to Chandrakirti, Shantideva, and so forth, they refute Chittamatra. Now Tsongkhapa, when he encountered an accomplished Dzogchen master and received teachings from him, and I checked this out, I know the source, and I've cited the source in my book, what's it now called? Balancing the Mind. That was my doctoral dissertation. But I really rummaged through the 18 volumes of Tsongkhapa's writings and found the account where he met with this Dzogchen master, received instruction from him, and having received the whole thing, he received the Dzogchen teachings, then Tsongkhapa commented, that teaching, it's perfect and it's complete. And then he went on and did his own thing. And but that's what he said, it's perfect and it's complete. Nothing to add, nothing to subtract, nothing to refute. Well, he refuted Chittamatra. He didn't refute Dzogchen. They can't be the same. So some Galupas try to refute Dzogchen, but then they're refuting Tsongkhapa. And some Dzogchenpas try to refute Tsongkhapa. I don't believe either one of them. I think they're sparring. They're sparring. It's known, I mean, so Mugila had 6 years of training in a Gelugpa monastic university. I had something pretty comparable, if we include Switzerland as well. And one of the points of debate, this is not only out on the chura, out on the debating courtyard, but there are multiple reasons to debate. Back in classical India, when you get some of these Indian masters, you know, Indian Buddhist masters debating with various, how do you say, masters of other schools, they're out for blood. out for blood, they're out to win. Because they feel, you know, these people are really advocating something false. You know, and they go for it. So the debates back then, but they were shows. They were really something. And if you lost a debate, if you were a prominent representative of your school, like maybe the head of a monastery, and you're advocating, let's say, Chittamatra, and some Hindu scholar comes, and what would happen? This would happen. I mean, it's kind of cool. I know this is a tangent, but it's a bit cool, isn't it? This was what would happen not infrequently, is if you had a top gun among the Hindu philosophers, and then a top gun among the Buddhist philosophers, really like, you know, fastest draw in the West kind of thing, where they're really sharp, and they defeat everybody around them. Then almost like, you know, like a world boxing championship. Really, very similar. The king would say, okay, let's convene a match. Let's convene a match. And they'd bring these two in with their entourages and so forth. And they'd have a public debate. And it would be witnessed by a lot of people who really know what's going on. And it would not infrequently happen. Somebody will win, to the victor go the spoils. The other one would have to convert. And his monastery would become the other side. So the stakes were high. So it was really a sport. But the sport, I mean, it was not death. There was no blood involved. It was more like the Olympics, you know. I mean, but it was a big deal. So that was a tangent. So where did I go back from the tangent? So the Dzogchen. So just that. Oh, yes, so there are multiple reasons for debating. Back then, the stakes could be really high. You could lose your whole monastery. You might have to convert to some other tradition you didn't really want to, but you lost, so what are you going to do? This shows how powerfully the classical Indians believed in reason. I think they believed in reason much more than we do nowadays. I don't think modernity believes that much in reason. Some do, often not. But back then, boy, reason... big. That if two come together, one wins, and it was a rational argument and defeated, well, then you just convert over until you can beat them right back again. Then you can come back to your home. You can come back home. So, multiple reasons for debating. Well, here's one reason. When I had my years of training first in India, then in Switzerland, what I was told, as we're, you know, within a community of Buddhists and we're debating different schools and so forth and so on, Rikpa Pelwe Chetu. Rikpa Pelwe, why do you debate? to increase your intelligence, to sharpen the blade of your intelligence, your keenness, your intellect. Right? And so you sharpen your sword. You sharpen your sword back and forth. And so I was told by Genlo Sangatso, the abbot in our monastery, as you're training here with me, because he was the only teacher in the monastery at that time, we only had 30 monks, he said, one half of what you learn will be from me, the teacher, one half of what you learn will be from your fellow debaters. It'll be half and half, right? And so then what would happen then is sometimes one person in the debate might take the role of Madhyamaka, one of the monks, and another monk might take the role of Chittamatra. And they whack at it, you know, and each one absolutely defending, you know, one the Chittamatra, one the Madhyamaka view, and they would go at it. And somebody's going to win the debate. And then the next day they might do the opposite. And the one who's defending Madhyamaka could defend Chittamatra, Roya. And so once a year in Dharamsala, I'm just giving you lore here, but sometimes it's fun, you can take a break. But once a year in Dharamsala, I was there for 4 years the first time and really engaged with the community. But once a year, I think it was Losar, must have been Losar. Then, like the kings of old in India, His Holiness, the government, would then stage a public debate. And they would bring two top guns, pretty much from the Gelugpa tradition. I think always from the Gelugpa tradition, because they were the ones really known for, you know, highlighting the debate more than any other tradition recently. And so, 1 year that I was there, two of my teachers were chosen as the top guns. Genlo Sangatso Che. Tene Gishe Ngam Taige Yemada Samge. I think it was Gishe Ngam Taige. He was, wasn't it? So Genlo Sangatso, my abbot under whom I trained in the monastery, Gishe Ngam Taige, from whom I had received all the foundational training in the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, and they're two absolutely splendid human beings. They're so warm, so kind, knowledgeable, brilliant teachers both. I'm not exaggerating. They really were marvelous. They really were. It's not just guru devotion. They were really marvelous. Both passed away by now. But so these two, and they knew each other. It's a love fest, you know. I mean, they're Buddhist monks in the same tradition. But then they get up on, you know, this New Year's celebratory period, beginning of the year. And you got, I don't know, maybe 500 monks, something like that. And then it was the prize fight, you know. The monks got the really good seats close to the ring, and then the lay people out, you know, outside. But hundreds and hundreds of people would come to watch. And the more erudite that you were, the more you could really follow, right? And if you didn't understand much, well, at least you could watch it, and it was good entertainment because there's a lot of dance. Yeah, yeah, tee! And stomping, and I mean, it's really theater. And it's fun. And you think, man, these guys are just going to rip each other's eyeballs out. You know, yeah, ta, you know. Just, whoa, they must really just like each other, you know. And they're good friends, you know. But they're going at, they're whacking, you know, tongue and hammer and tongue and whacking away until finally the debate's over. And everybody got good entertainment. But it's not just entertainment like watching a movie. They're seeing two really top-notch scholars sharpening their swords. Sharpening swords with each other, you know. And of course, it's all done. One thing you might see if you've ever seen a video of it, lots of laughter. The really good ones. Gemalang yoro. Laughter. And it's part of it. It's not contrived. But there's kind of a joyousness of it. I know it. I've done it a lot myself. But when you see that somebody's, you've just gotten somebody vulnerable, you see, I can turn this. I can turn it, I can make you directly contradict yourself. That's when you really start having fun. It's a ball. I mean, don't do it anymore. I don't want to do it anymore, but it was good for a while. After all I wanted to do was meditate, you know. And Geshe Raptan taught us that. Geshe Raptan, he was a yogi on the hill, and he was absolutely first class. He was absolutely first class. He's a debater, a master, totally accomplished. But he said, after you've been on the debating courtyard, after you've been on the debating courtyard and you won or lost, and he won a lot more than he lost because he was top notch. But after you've been on the debating courtyard and you've clapped your way through, and you, in his case, you'll win most of them. Then when it's all over, he said, now's the time. And a lot of the monks would not heed this, but he was a yogi as well as a scholar. After the debate's over, go back to your room sit quietly and meditate. Because the whole point of that was to gain new insight, and now let it sink in. Don't just plan your next debate. Don't just win. Now let it sink in. Let it transform. He was a yogi. So, a few more minutes from Enrique. Can you tell us more about coarse laxity? If one day in the future we arrive at stage 4, how will we recognize coarse laxity? How will we dispel it? How will we be sure of its absence? So very, very good practical questions. It's relative. So as you know, as a physicist, apart from general relativity, from what I know, apart from general relativity, the magnitude of energy, how much energy in any given system, what have you, is always relative. General relativity is the one exception. But apart from that, for example, the zero-point energy of the vacuum, without bringing in general relativity, which you don't need to bring in at all, how much energy is there in the vacuum that is energy intrinsic to empty space itself? Well, if you do the equations that I did from the context of quantum field theory, and for me, since I'm such a terrible mathematician, not gifted, really not gifted as a mathematician, but just dogged, like an old mule. That's what I was. I just was like a mule. And I went through it. It was like 4 equations, and I expanded it into 30 pages. And so I could understand every single step to my satisfaction. And when you do all the equations, for me it was 30 pages of equations, the energy density of the empty space turns out to be infinite. But a physicist looking at that, what do you do with that? You have no instrument that can measure infinite anything. So what do you do? I mean, it's kind of cool metaphysically, but what on earth do you do with infinite energy density? And that's what it says. Well, what you do is you can normalize it. So you have a figure there. It's infinite. Okay, that's a number. But now if you wish, you can simply normalize it, or it's called normalize or regularize, and you make it zero. Okay, the energy density of empty space is zero. It's relative, or you can make it finite, and physicists did all three. So that's simply a parallel here, maybe a rather far-fetched parallel, but since you're a physicist, you got it. Laxity, likewise, is relative to context. So once you've achieved stage 4, then within that context, and you only know it when you're there, you can't imagine it prior to that, but once you're there, you've segued into it, you get tastes of it, you get spikes into it, and then you basically make stage 4 your home, and that's your normal session. Then within that context, where you're sitting 45 minutes or an hour and in the flow the whole time, within that context, you'll note on occasion that the mind is really quite bright, quite clear. And then on occasion, not as much. Now, prior to that, we all know what it's like to be dull. And these are two different terms, jingwa tang mupa, taraki kewayore. So laxity is a technical term that you find within the context of shamatha vipassana, and mupa is an untechnical term. It means dull, muddled, unclear. There's another word, well, of course, sloth and torpor comes from there. But it's just dull. And so all of you, I think all of you by now have had a chance to experience dullness, right? Especially in the supine position. That's when you slip from laxity, dullness, to sleepiness, to snoring. So that's the slippery slope. So dullness, we all know, the mind is not clear. But now in the stage 4, and you'll experience dullness on stage 1, 2, 3, there's no question about that, antidote it. Dullness for us on stages 1, 2, 3 is when you have less clarity of attention than you have when you begin, than you had when you begin, or than you normally have. Right now, if you're all awake, you're still engaged, you're attentive, I say, okay, you don't have dullness. But some of you may be, when's he going to stop? When's dinner? When's dinner? Is it 6:02 yet? Kathleen, give us the mudra. Please give us the mudra. I got one more minute. And so, there we go. That's dullness. Get up on stage 4. It's not dullness. You've maintained the clarity that you had. But now you'll slip into something a bit better, and then you won't. And when you slip back and you see it's not as clear as it was, within that context, relative to stage 4, it's not as clear as it was. That's coarse laxity. And then how do you overcome that? Well, this is where Chandogomi, Chandragomi, Lamrishmanani Odit. Chandragomi, the great, I don't know what century, maybe 7th, something like that. Actually, Chittamatran, Raya, Semzamba, Imida. But he wrote about this stage. He clearly practiced shamatha. And he got to this stage 4, and wanted to transition over to stage 5. And then he wrote this verse that when I'm there and trying to make this transition to move out of coarse laxity, right? To move beyond that to stage 5, where you still have medium, you have only medium excitation, because you're free of coarse excitation in stage 4. Stage 5, you still have medium excitation, but you no longer have coarse laxity, so it's medium. To make that transition from stage 4 to stage 5, he said, I paraphrase closely, he said, now when I crank it up, when I try more, I exert more effort, then the mind becomes agitated and I fall back. But when I slack off a bit, then I fall back into coarse laxity. And then I crank it up, then I get back to coarse, then I get back to coarse excitation, then I, yeah. They basically make that sound. Frustration. Like, what to do? I think he ends, what shall I do? What shall I do? So that's where you really, now you're taking on a new balancing act. What is the balancing act for stages 1 to 4?
Relaxation.
Relaxation and stability. Thank you. I'd have to definitely find a whip if nobody got a good answer to that one. But it's relaxation and stability, right? Not losing relaxation, developing stability. Stage 4 to 5, it's stability and vividness. Stability and vividness. And it comes just by doing the practice more and tweaking it, learning how to fine-tune, like Ravi Shankar, when he spent, an hour or so tuning his sitar. Fine-tune. That's where introspection really comes in. Okay? Until then, it was mindfulness. It got you to stage 4. To get to stage 5, it's introspection, to do the very fine-tuning. Okay? And I think on that note, here's a real quick one, and I can do this. Yeah, and this is a matter. So we've been dealing with deep issues. Relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta. Zero-point energy of the vacuum. That's not trivial. And this isn't certainly not trivial. The next point's not trivial, but it's on another dimension altogether. Okay? It's different. This is cultural. Nothing what I said thus far was cultural. I mean, just maybe the way they clap the hands in debate. But nothing, it was all, real core dharma. But here's a question, and that is, I'm curious why we shouldn't point our feet to the front of the room. I never liked this rule, mainly because you can't stretch after sitting without worrying about offending someone. Did the Buddha teach this, or is this a cultural thing? Why have you personally adopted this particular ritual or belief? And that's because feet are evil. They could be, although I doubt it. It is cultural. It's courtesy. It's manners. Do I care? I don't care. I could care less. I mean, if your feet really smell badly, and you're sitting near me, and you poke them up, and I can see the toe jam dripping down, I don't like that. That's kind of disgusting. But apart from that, if you bathe regularly, and the feet, I mean, feet are feet, So, no, nothing with me. But we are in Thailand, and if you go into a Thai temple and you point your feet towards the Buddha or to the altar, that'll be considered really discourteous. Pretty much throughout Asia. I was attending a teaching of by His Holiness Dalai Lama once as a monk, and no, it wasn't I. It was somebody else. I was there. I remember what I did. I had my Bodhisattvatara with me. And it was in my jola. And so it was in a container. A jola means the shoulder bag that monks often carry. And I laid it on the ground, and there was a carpet there, and it was inside the jola. And someone said, pick it up. Even though it was inside, don't put it on the ground. Put it on your lap. Hang it from something. It's the Bodhisattvatara. This is Dharma. It's sacred. Don't put it on the ground. I'm sure it was not I, but somebody else I heard. It was a Westerner, and it was one of these big teachings where everybody's jammed in like sardines, and somebody's walking through and was about to step over a baby. There was a baby lying on the ground, and somebody, very carefully, not going to step on the baby, but was about to step over. The mother just about freaked out. That you absolutely don't do. You don't step, have the bottom of your feet over anything. You don't put that over a person. You don't put it over a baby.